Hello, everyone, and welcome to another installment of Literary Loitering, the geek show's arts and books podcast, more or less.
You were going to say dedicated arts and books podcast, and then you clearly thought, we're not that dedicated.
That's scary how well you read my mind.
It's something to do on a morning.
I mean, we are the podcast that covers books and arts, because God help us, no one else will.
Yes. I think Rob's hit on our new slogan there too, hasn't he? Literary Loitering, the podcast that basically passes the time.
Apparently, we are popular with taxi drivers. Who would have thought?
We found this out, yeah. I could be, I had that bloke from the internet in the back of my cab story at one point.
Yeah. It's such a bizarre thing to find out though, isn't it?
It really is. Because,
you know, when you think about it, when you think about what we are, and you think about taxi drivers, there's a degree of separation there, isn't there?
There is, yeah. I mean, I only learned to drive a few years back.
I'm still confused by the idea that people willingly listen to the show.
Not just willingly listen to the show, apparently enjoy it.
Christ, I know I would mute my audio if I could get away with it.
Should we move on before this blows our minds?
Yes.
That's a very good point, Rob or Graham. I agree completely.
Yes. Shall we start with, we normally start with something that's a bit of a throwback to a previous story, but unfortunately, George R.R. Martin is prevaricating quietly this week.
And it's been a very quiet week for Donald Trump as well.
Yeah. And nobody's tried to trademark popular English words.
So that's the end of the show.
No, we do have a throwback story to something we have discussed before. We have mentioned the, what's it called again? The Future Library.
Is this that one that's like buried in a forest?
Yes. Andrew, I don't know if you want to start doing the Game of Thrones theme just for comfort.
I mean, I might just kind of quietly whisper it to myself while you say the story.
That's fine. Yeah, that works. It's not distracting at all.
Okay, I'll stop then.
Yes, the Future Library Project is a project that takes...
I mean, I never said I wouldn't start back up again.
I suppose you did say you'd stop doing it to yourself, and that was definitely not to yourself.
Yes, I just had to pause, stick cotton buds in my ears so I couldn't hear my own terrible shrieking. Anyway, Future Library, tell me about this thing.
Future Library is a project started by the Scottish artist Katie Patterson, which takes books by leading contemporary authors and makes sure no one can read them for ages.
Yeah, it's like 100 years, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And previous entrants have included Margaret Atwood, because it would be weird if it didn't involve Margaret Atwood, really, wouldn't it? Elif Shafak and David, no, not that one, Mitchell.
Which is the not that one David Mitchell now, because they both write books.
This is true. I mean, it would be great if it was that David Mitchell and his book was just called Are We the Baddies?
Yes. Yeah, that would be a pretty vital tool to understanding the culture of 100 years ago, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, in the future, we don't know what's going to happen. You know, we're not prophets. There's none of us are called Nostradamus or anything like that. So we don't know what kind of uniforms.
Everything is going to burn.
We don't know what kind of uniforms people are going to be wearing in the future. We don't know what's going to be in fashion. We don't know.
Rags. Yeah. That will be the only fashion.
We don't know if there's going to be a fashionable new walk where you walk with one leg straight and then the other leg straight and you basically stomp down on the ground with each step.
I mean, if John Cleese couldn't make it happen, I don't think anyone can.
Well, I don't know. The Germans seem to approach goose stepping quite well. The North Koreans are certainly good at it. I know that.
Yes. So yeah, that would be quite a good tactic, couldn't it, if we could do a future library for fashion?
Yes.
If we could predict what people are going to wear in 100 years' time, that would be a right money spinner. A money spinner that none of us would be around to enjoy, admittedly.
I'm going to make a prediction there then. I'm going to say wing collars, bell-bottom jeans, and massive shoulder pads, because they're due a comeback in about 100 years.
Yeah, once the traumatic memories have faded, people yes. will embrace them again.
Exactly.
I'm slightly disappointed that you think of this in terms of, oh, let's try and match what the people of 100 years will be wearing. No, no. What we need to do is try and convince the people of 100 years' time, yeah, that this is what we all wore all the time. I mean, just you weren't anyone unless your high heels had at least 10 inches.
Yes.
Oh, God.
And ended in sheer razor blades.
I've just realised. Andrew's going to try and convince all the men to wear a codpiece and a coat of many pockets.
Yes.
In many ways, early 21st century fashion was defined by the crotch window. This is already better than just burying a book for 100 years.
Exactly. It's so much better.
Wait. They bury the books.
Yes.
Yes.
Like it's not just some warehouse or whatever that's got a do not open until 21,018.
That would actually probably be better in a kind of Indiana Jones way, I think. But no, they bury the books in a forest.
2,180. Oh, whoa. In a forest.
Yep.
Like, just... So they're just digging holes in forests.
Yep.
And putting books in them.
Yep. Not the books
themselves. Are they just, like, wrapping the books in cling film first?
Well, obviously, yeah, they'll do that, because otherwise it would make very good fertilizer.
Let's see if I can make this a hat trick of things that make Andrew say, whoa, hang on about this project.
Go on.
After the books are dug up from the forest, the trees in the forest will be used to create the paper to publish the books.
But for why?
Wasn't the whole point of us using digital media in an effort to protect the trees, which create the oxygen which allow us to breathe continuously on this planet?
God, that's a point. What if there are new environmental regulations in 100 years' time that forbid the cutting down of trees to make books? Then they're jiggered.
It's a shame we had to destroy the last forest on Earth, but
yeah.
The book left very specific instructions.
I always knew it was going to be either the Catholics or the artists who destroyed the world.
But thank God we can now all read Cloud Atlas. And this is the version that doesn't even have a Korean Hugo Weaving in it.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
Happy memories, eh?
Oh, God, yeah. It's Sean Connery and Thunderball all over again.
I think the cannibal Hugh Grant was my favourite bit, though.
Hugh Grant's always been a cannibal. You can see it in his eyes.
He seemed to be eating Ben Whishaw on the telly gigs recently. I think that's what it was.
Sorry, no, I can't say that.
Oh, Paddington.
Yes, I think I've already pushed it about as far as I can.
Oh. Which is, you wouldn't think Ben Whishaw would be the bear in that relationship.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
I mean, I think I'm just dancing around things because, oh my God, burying books in forests so they can be dug up in 100 years and then the forests turned into publishing.
I suppose at least they've managed mostly to pick authors who were, you know, pretty good. I really fear for the moment where they announce they're going to inflict a late period Irving Welsh novel on our descendants.
Oh God, no, not Trainspotting 2. Have you tried reading that?
I've tried reading Irving Welsh in the past, and even his supposed golden age stuff leaves me absolutely cold.
Okay, yes. Billy Shirley then, when like our great grandchildren dig it up, flick through the pages, they can at least say, "Oh, I get why this was buried. Okay, back in the hole."
Well, yes. Do you remember on the last episode we were talking about Women's Weekly, was it, and the exploitative contracts? And I mentioned that I'd had the, it's not privilege, it's the opposite of privilege, reading some of the fiction. Yeah, so some of the so-called fiction from women, from those sorts of magazines. Not specifically Women's Weekly, but from those sorts of magazines. I said, it's not very difficult to get through, and there's a distinct lack of big words.
Yes.
I didn't realise that at the time, but now that we mentioned Irvin Welsh, it does remind me a lot.
I suppose when they dug up a copy of A Decent Ride by Irvin Welsh, they would at least have the satisfaction of saying, oh, that's why they started a species-wiping nuclear war. They were bored.
Yeah. I have one question about this burying books. It's a Scottish artist that started it, yeah?
Yeah.
Where is the forest?
It's in Oslo.
Why is it in Oslo?
That is a pretty good question, isn't it? I suppose that Oslo feels like a pretty safe environment to run a 100-year project. Scandinavia is always kind of the same, isn't it?
My main question is, it's a Scottish artist and they've chosen to bury the books in Oslo. Is this because, you know, if you buried them in a forest near Glasgow, the books would get nicked?
I suppose.
Well, I assume it's because in 100 years... they don't want out of sentence having to dive into the lost city of Scotlantis to find books.
Maclantis.
Yes.
Sorry, Scotlantis is just amazing.
I mean, in 100 years' time, all of Scotland could be one enormous Donald Trump golf course, so you've got that risk.
Yeah, but I'm just imagining mermen with kilts.
Yes, Guillermo del Toro really messed up not including that in The Shape of Water.
Yeah, he needed a kill. That would have set the entire thing off completely, you know, proper red tartan killed.
He'd have got a super Best Picture Oscar for that.
Oh, God, yeah. And don't forget...
I mean, it's quite frankly why I still to this day refuse to see that film.
Yeah. And don't forget, he's got to have a really well-made sporran as well.
Yes. Waterproof, obviously.
Yes, obviously. No, his bagpipes have to be waterproof.
His bagpipes can just be an octopus that he's kind of manhandled into the right shape. Would you like to see if you can take us somewhere else from that?
Yes, I will. I'll take you to literary prizes. Now, we've talked about some literary prizes in the past, and I think on the last episode we were talking about Helen Lederer's new literary prize, the comedy one for women.
Yes, yeah.
Because the Ward House Prize is, it's kind of chauvinistic, isn't it?
It's kind of chauvinistic, and it nominated Life of Pi for Best Comic Novel, as we found out.
Yeah, in the year that Terry Pratchett released Monstrous Regiment and The We Free Men. So, yeah, you've got to question the decision-making of the people who run the Ward House Prize. But anyway, this year, the Nobel Prize for Literature was basically cancelled, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Because of all sorts of scandals of sexual assault and various things like that.
I thought you were going to say because all the good books have been buried in a forest.
Actually, that's a point. Isn't this a bit like, you know, Wu-Tang Clan did that one album that...
Yeah.
Only one person can ever listen to it.
And that was bought by Martin Shkreli, the price-gouging AIDS drugs magnate who looks like Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man in the third film when he goes all emo.
Oh, you mean...
Is he in prison now?
Yep.
I think he is, yeah.
Because it got seized? It actually made the news. I was surprised. It was, of all his possessions... The one bit that made the biggest headline was the fact that they'd seized his Wu-Tang Clan album.
There was a piece in Harper's Monthly when his trial was going on where they actually printed the real deliberations in jury selection.
And oh my God, yeah, and they couldn't find anyone.
Yeah, as you would expect, about 90% of it was people saying, I could not be unbiased towards this guy because he's a cock. But one person did say, I could not be an unbiased juror in this trial because he disrespected the Wu-Tang Clan.
Nice. It's amazing.
That was like my second favourite one, because I'm pretty sure one of them was just, no, I can't be unbiased, I just don't like his face.
Yes, it was! The system works.
Yes.
What's going on with the Nobel Literature Prize?
Well, anyway, the Swedish Academy, after they cancelled the Nobel Prize for Literature, and why are they always academies? You know, there's the, you know, the Academy in America, there's the Swedish Academy, which sounds like a school of some sort. But anyway,
it sounds like a dodgy film from the 70s, doesn't it?
Swedish Academy.
Lessons in love.
Now in Technicolor. Basically, they've decided to do a replacement award, which has been set up by a host of Swedish cultural figures, and they've unveiled a shortlist that has four authors on there out of 47 names that were put forward and opened up to a public vote with an expert jury and various things like that, right? The finalists include Haruki Murakami.
Nice.
And Neil Gaiman.
Ooh.
Yeah. Marisa Conde is also one of them as well.
Right.
And Kim, is it Thuy?
I don't know. I genuinely thought you were going to say Kim Jong-un.
No, no, no. Her surname is spelled T-H-U with a little apostrophe thing on top, Y. So.
Oh, yes. Yeah, heard of her. Oh, never read anything.
Yeah. Those are the four authors. And it's nice to see that there are actually two female writers going up against two male writers.
Mm. And also, I mean, it's kind of a populist selection, but it's classy populist. I mean, Murakami is obviously someone who straddles the bridge, a serious novelist who also sells well.
Yeah.
I don't like to think of this, it's like more just authors who are good without necessarily being the incredibly snobbish, oh, you plebs will have never heard of this author that we're giving the prize to.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. Can we have this just in place of the old Nobel Prize? It seems better.
Yeah, on the surface, it does seem better at the moment.
Yeah. Also, can we do this for the Oscars as well? Instead of having the popular film category, which is possibly the most condescending thing I've ever heard.
The winner doesn't get a statue, they just get a pat on the head, and the president of the Academy goes, see, people liked you.
Yeah, but this is the thing.
But the crystal just kind of opens up and goes, well, I guess you all liked this one.
The thing is, the popular film category, it is now possible then, because of that, that a film like Transformers The Last Night could win Best Popular Film.
Yes.
And then be an award-winning film.
Suicide Squad won an Oscar, you know?
Yeah, I know. Don't
also,
remind me.
I'm pretty sure one of the Transformers films already has an Oscar for, like, sound mixing or something.
Can we just get rid of the technical Oscars? And we'll have, like, the...
Or maybe actually give the technical Oscars to things that are technically impressive.
Yeah.
Instead of just the... But let's pick a bunch of films out of a hat and give them awards.
Yeah, but the thing is, you can't choose the technically impressive ones because most of the time the technically impressive ones probably aren't made in America.
Hmm.
Which means they won't qualify for the American Oscars. That's why the best film category is best American or English film, I suppose, not best film all over the world.
Oh, God, yeah. That's painfully true. And it can't be animated either. It just can't.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Oscars are rubbish, aren't they?
They are. They are absolute toffs.
Shall we stay kind of on film news?
Yeah, let's go.
The film of Kevin Kwan's novel, Crazy Rich Asians, is currently making Kevin Kwan crazy rich by an incredible coincidence.
Yeah, it's doing very, very well.
It's been a massive hit. It's a movie with an entirely Asian cast, which is normally Hollywood's like, can we maybe squeeze Scarlett Johansson in there somewhere? Don't worry, you know, we're not going to just put her in as a white person. We'll give her a Fu Manchu moustache.
Well, here's the thing.
No one will notice.
Yeah. Here's the thing. I actually saw this online when they did Ghost in the Shell, and there were all these memes about trying to crowbar Scarlett Johansson into, like, every Asian role. Somebody actually wrote a little piece about how they actually went back to watch the Joy Luck Club, which was, I think it was the first film to actually have an all Chinese cast, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think, well,
the surprise, Scarlett Johansson was all of them.
They went back to check if there was a Scarlett Johansson cameo anywhere in there.
Yeah, so Crazy Rich Asians, it's doing very well. It's been a bit of a feel-good story, and its author could see in the new year in jail. Yeah.
Yay!
2018, guys, nothing good is allowed to happen. This is to do with a bylaw from his native Singapore, where everyone has to complete mandatory military service. He left Singapore at 11, where I think his value to the Singaporean military would be kind of limited.
So, hang on. He left Singapore at 11, and he didn't live there for how long?
I don't think he's sort of lived there since.
Okay. So,
I guess he kept on to, like, his dual nationality status then.
Yes, what seems to have happened is that he only rescinded Singaporean citizenship in 1994 when he was 18 years old and therefore eligible to sign up for the military.
Okay, so is he a Singaporean citizen now?
I don't believe so, no.
So why would he be going to jail for national service?
I suppose if you avoid it when you're eligible for it, as if he did renounce his citizenship at the age of 18, he would have been, the offence stays, and the possible penalties are a fine of up to 10,000 Singaporean dollars or imprisonment of up to 3 years.
Well, given that he's now, like, crazy rich.
Yes.
Okay, I think he'll just pay the fine.
Yeah, the fine equates at just shy of £6,000, so I think he might be able to afford it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, even I could probably afford to pay that off. So take that, Singapore, you're not tricking me into your army.
Yeah, oh, apparently, the slight nuance I've missed, it is illegal for men to give up citizenship without having completed military service. Which,
okay, that's a bit of a catch 22, isn't it?
Apparently, Singapore wants its army to be full of people who have no real stake in the country and can't wait to get out of it.
That to me is just a recipe for conquest. I would be eyeing Singapore and going, I'm going to get all these people to emigrate. I'm going to give them a good life in my country, then I'm going to send them back so they can do their national service. And while they're in the military, I'm going to go in with my army because these soldiers are already infiltrated their army.
I'm just going to stroll onto an airbase and say, hey, that fighter jet, can I have one of those? Whatever.
Are you suggesting that Crazy Rich Asians is the result of a secret Singaporean sleeper cell plot?
No.
I'm but not... we're also not saying that.
Yeah, exactly.
It's too chillingly plausible, isn't it?
No, it's not plausible at all.
Yeah, it's absolute nonsense, isn't it? This is a really silly story. I can only assume that Singapore is pursuing this as a way of saying to their own citizens, look, no one gets away with it, but it is really daft.
Yeah, I'm just, I hate to say it, but it's Singapore, and if Singapore is like other countries in that area of the world, it's only valid until the first judge has been bribed.
yes.
Maybe I'll have somebody tell me off for saying that, but, you know, prove me wrong.
Yes.
Also, I suppose it depends. Can you bribe the judge for under £6,000?
Probably, yeah.
If that's the kind of money that they're willing to pursue a citizen halfway across the world for, they can't be doing that great.
Well, let's put it this way. In that,
also, surely this whole process must cost a fair amount.
Yes,
it does. Probably more than £6,000. But the thing is, in that area of the world, they are prone to all sorts of things like bribery and propaganda and stuff like that. Have you seen what's happening in Myanmar with that book?
No.
Have you not heard about this? Right. The Myanmar military, right, have published a book about the Rohingya crisis. Several of the pictures they've used to illustrate their point, it's basically propaganda against the Rohingya, right? Mm. But several of the pictures that they've used to prove their point, one of them is a picture that's been altered. It's been black and whited, and it's a picture from Rwanda in the 90s during that particular incident.
Yes.
Other pictures are about the Bangladesh War of Independence. And the actual photographers who took these photos are still alive and have come forward and said, why the hell are you using our pictures? These has nothing to do with the Rohingya. What the hell are you talking about?
That's incredible. I mean, you know what?
Fantastic.
Say what you want about the Third Reich. At least Leni Riefenstahl knew how to shoot her own damn pictures.
And I bet you woke up this morning never thinking you'd say that.
No, I woke up thinking, hey, it's Saturday, it's about time for my unwise defence of Leni Riefenstahl.
I have a story here about a dastardly fox.
Oh.
It's a story about Reynard the Fox, which is a medieval children's story which fell drastically out of fashion for its cynical, shocking storylines, which means we'd probably adore it.
Yes.
It's due to be welcomed back into the mainstream culture in a modern retelling which will not shy away from the most disturbing elements. Now,
the juicy deets, Rob.
When are they going to get to the fireworks factory?
Yeah, I'll get to that in a second. This is a story that Disney deemed far too dark because the fox is a thief and a murderer.
Right.
Excellent.
This is not the Fantastic Mr. Fox or anything like that. The project to basically bring Reynard back is based on archive material from the Bodleian Libraries and Bristol University. It's going to be a new illustrated children's book. I am getting very Plague Dogs, Watership Down-esque vibes here already.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, at Disney back in 1937, right? And this is just how bizarre this decision is, right?
Yeah.
The story of Reynard the Fox was explored, but ultimately rejected by Disney in 1937 when it was looking for a new animated film to make after the success of Snow White and the Seven Dwarves.
Oh my guys, Snow White's been a big hit. How about the murdery fox?
Well, it's not like Snow White is a nice story, is it?
It's true.
And Sleeping Beauty most definitely isn't a nice story.
Yes. I suppose part of the reason why this is surprising is because, as you've illustrated there, normally when Disney comes across a really horrible fairy tale, they just change everything until it's anodyne pap.
Yeah.
But apparently this could not be done.
There's some really good bits to this Reynard the Fox bit, though, right? Because Disney eventually took the fox idea and applied it to Robin Hood, which, you know, I've got to say, their version of Robin Hood, I kind of adore.
Yeah, it's nice.
Oodle-ally, oodle-ally, and all that. Golly, what a day. But the new version of Reynard the Fox is due out in 2020. There's some great bits here, though, that are taken from the old Reynard the Fox. In particular, the title of the Reynard the Fox story, years and years and years and years and years and years, and years ago, the most delectable history of Reynard the Fox, newly corrected and purged from all the grossness in both phrase and matter, as also augmented and enlarged with sundry excellent morals and expositions upon every several chapters.
Right.
It's all written in, you know, that old English, though, where the F is the yes and the yes is the F and various things like that. Yeah.
So as long as nobody sucks anything, we're safe.
Yes. Totally safe. Nobody sucks anything. Which makes me confused now. So did they not call it a fox like we do? Did they call it a sox?
The murder of a sox.
Because I'm sorry, but you know those posh hunts they do. I mean, sox hunting is not the same as fox hunting.
Excellent use. Yeah,
sox hunting is just when you pick them out the washing and find you've only got one.
Exactly. Yeah.
Excellent use of Cockney rhyming slang there with the posh hunts.
I'm glad you liked it. Anyway, moving on.
Yes. Shall we go somewhere else that's perhaps slightly dark and unlikely to be made into a Disney film anytime soon?
Are we talking like The Hunchback of Notre Dame?
Get that notebook of story ideas out.
Yes.
See,
pedal smut.
Yeah, I find it ironic that we're talking about that we've mentioned Disney and dark stories, because does anyone remember The Hunchback of Notre Dame?
Yes. Yeah, they certainly purged that of unsettling stuff incompletely.
Yeah, although there were the two kind of biggest failures for Disney, which are kind of beloved now, The Black Cauldron and The Hunchback of Notre Dame. And he's blatantly, I mean, they've got that, what's his name, singing about raping Esmeralda in the cartoon. I'm like, what?
But it's okay, because the lovable gargoyle sidekick would very much murder him.
Exactly.
Then again, isn't Scar, like, eaten to death by his own hyenas at the end of The Lion King?
Yep.
Wow.
People. I mean, I'm starting to think maybe it's a bit of a glass houses situation, Disney.
Yeah. Okay, maybe I'll change this. Maybe rather than saying they're not going to make a film set here, I will say, Disney, I challenge you to make a film set in Guantanamo Bay.
Give it time.
Eventually it will happen.
I mean, do you remember The Rescuers Down Under?
Dimly, yeah.
Do you not remember the hunter in The Rescuers Down Under? Yeah, his version of Home on the Range, where he's singing about basically ripping off their hides and stuff like that.
I don't remember that.
Home on the Range.
The version of Rescuers Down Under that I found on the internet was very different.
Yes, it was. Was it Home on the Range, where the critters are tied up in chains and stuff like that? I'm like, it's so dark, it's like the DC Universe.
But yes, Alex Johnson, who we have spoke about several times before, he publishes these fine lists of books in The Independent, has given us a list of the books that are not allowed to be transported to detainees in Guantanamo Bay. There's some expected political titles, Hidden Agendas by John Pilger, Blair's Wars by John Kampfner, a series of books by the human rights lawyer Clive Stafford Smith, who actually curated this list, but also some rather odd omissions. The Merchant of Venice by William Shakespeare is not allowed.
Why?
Dunno. Anti-Semitism?
What? It's been around for hundreds of years.
So was anti-Semitism. Coincidence.
Are we blaming Shakespeare for anti-Semitism now?
Well, I mean, he's not here fighting these allegations. I find that very suspicious.
Other ones include The Diary of a Young Girl by Anne Frank.
Okay, now I'm really confused. If you can't have Merchant of Venice because of anti-Semitism, surely you can have The Diary of a Young Girl by Anne Frank.
I think it's just too depressing a read. I don't want the business to get too upset now.
I would say that if a person who is imprisoned on suspicion of being a member of Al-Qaeda or ISIS wants to read The Diary of Anne Frank, you've probably got the wrong person.
Yeah.
What? Guantanamo Bay? Get the wrong person, Graham. Yes. Who's writing the fiction now?
it's not as if they just put out a bounty for any cab driver someone could beat up and turn in, is it? Yes.
The world's horrible, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
The world is grim, but there are shafts of light, I would say, which is that despite Guantanamo Bay's reputation as a place of horrendous torture, detainees are actually forbidden from reading Booky Wook 2 by Russell Brand.
Oh, good. It's good to know that even they have standards.
Yes. I mean, we'll waterboard you, we'll put you in stress positions, we'll blast out heavy metal music when you're trying to sleep, but come on, guys, it's called Booky Wook 2.
We're not monsters.
Oh, God. I mean, what does that tell you about Russell Brand's Booky Wook 2? The fact that they won't let inmates of Guantanamo Bay read it?
I don't know. It's the sort of thing that I would imagine if I were running a torture camp, which I'm definitely not, okay? Let's put those rumours to bed. I would just order in the audiobook. Jesus, this is going to follow me around all my life.
Well, I think they know, Graham. After all, the torture camp is called literary loitering.
So, yes, Clive Stafford Smith, who released these books and who is also on the list, has said that one of the possible motivations is to stop the detainees learning English, which, again, if the idea is to get actionable intelligence from them, that's not going to work. Also, the chances of learning English from a Russell Brand book are pretty minimal.
Well, hang on. I read one time that they were having to teach the inmates of Guantanamo Bay English in order to further communication and so they could ask them questions easier instead of having to rely on translators.
It's very strange, isn't it? Either one of these sources is wrong of American foreign policy is not very coherent.
I think the latter is probably the more likely.
Mm.
Or rather, the latter these days is probably the more likely.
Yes.
I think it's hard just to choose one of those.
Well, let's put it this way. America is effectively being run by Boris Johnson's special uncle.
God, do you think they're all having to read the art of the deal?
That would explain why all of them still can't speak coherent English.
Yes.
Actually, no. Oh, maybe it's brilliant. Maybe their idea is to make them all read that so that they think the prisoners, that they're going in to like offer up information as part of a negotiation for some kind of high-powered deal. They're just going to sit there and tell them everything. And they go, okay, I've told you all the information. Now let's talk about what you can do for me. Well, I'm going straight back into the jail cell. But I told you all that. I get it.
I think communication would be impeded in this by their habit of shouting the word "sad" at the end of every sentence.
Or maybe they're just trying to teach them English so they can figure out what covfefe means.
Yes.
That's it. Guantanamo Bay is all just an elaborate cover.
It's just one long project to try and work out what the hell Donald Trump's tweets are about.
I just realised Donald Trump is basically like King Kong on the Empire State Building, but on Twitter, isn't he?
It's another connection might be that two of the death metal bands who have been played to detainees in their sleep would include Rigged Witch Hunt and No Collusion.
Can you imagine, though, if you were a fan of Rigged Witch Hunt and No Collusion in Guantanamo Bay, they started playing you that. You're like, awesome!
Yes! There's got to be some metalheads in there, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of averages.
Yeah.
There's going to be somebody in there who's going to be into death metal, and they're going to look at them and go, yeah, this one may be a terrorist. Why? Because he listens to death metal. Are you sure that works?
I think there's like just one guy in Guantanamo Bay who's really into death metal. It's also quite kinky, and is just having the time of their lives.
Yeah.
like, stop beating him. He's trying to say something. Sir, he just keeps saying, harder, daddy.
Again, the law of averages.
Shall we definitely, definitely move on from this?
Yes.
Please, yes. Save me from myself.
Moving on from a place where you don't want to be incarcerated to a place where maybe you do, right? Here's a question. If you put a wanted advert for a librarian slash bookseller, yeah? Or if you could get a job as a librarian slash bookseller, where would you love to work?
I mean, there's so many options, aren't there?
Yeah.
There's so many options that I'm not even going to answer the question. There's just that many options.
What if the wanted ad said, wanted, barefoot bibliophile willing to punt Daniel Defoe to rich modern-day Robinson Crusoes at a luxury desert island resort?
I'd say, is this a sex thing? It sounds like a sex thing.
And I would reply, it could be if you're lucky.
Do I have to show up to the interview in bare feet?
The interview would probably be on the desert island.
Okay, but I mean, I'm still going to have to, you know, like, get a train to get to the airport. I don't want to sit bare feet on the plane now.
No, I'm not having it. No, you could wear shoes all the way there, but then when you get onto the white sand beaches with the, you know, with the lapping waves and the gentle breeze, and, you know, you may want to go barefoot at that point.
I mean, I was pretty happy recently to get a job on a North Shields industrial estate, so I don't feel like I can turn this down.
The pay's not very good.
I think my problem is just I don't like sand. It's coarse and it gets everywhere.
This is true. I mean, the pay's not very good. I've got to point that out. Philip Blackwell, the scion of the bookseller family, needs a Man Friday for possibly the world's most remote bookshop, which is based in the luxury eco-resort of Soneva Fushi in the Maldives. The pay is derisory, but the fringe benefits are unparalleled, said Blackwell. The role will evolve, and it is in part up to you to make the most of this unique opportunity. It's a dream job for many people. If I was 25 again, I would do it. Yeah, right.
Yeah, see, this sounded cool at first, but now it does sound very much like but it's okay, you get to live on this beautiful desert island. That means I don't really need to pay you, right?
Yes. I was going to say the qualifiers are kind of flooding in faster than, well, into water in the Maldives, which will be undersea in about 10 years' time anyway.
Yep. Well, the successful applicant will be expected to sign up for a minimum of 3 months, during which time they must write an entertaining and lively blog that captures the exhausting life of a desert island bookseller. Oh, and mingle with A-list celebrities and their friends. Now, some people would probably apply for this just for the chance to mingle with A-list celebrities and their friends for 3 months.
Yeah.
And it's the Maldives.
I notice it's not saying who the A-list celebrities are, though, is it? I mean,
well, all I'm going to say is I know how to convince Andrew.
Oh?
Yes.
So, is it by revealing that it was a line that actually pays lots and lots of money?
No, it's by revealing that Scarlett Johansson will be there without her husband.
I mean, maybe back in the good old days, before it turned out that maybe Scarlett Johansson was actually just a terrible, terrible person.
Yeah, true.
So when you say they're A-list celebrities, are you sure you're not misreading it as celebrities that are on A-list?
Okay, that's a different one.
Yeah,
and that might actually be more the case.
I think you can mix with celebrities who were on a list at quite a few prisons in London.
And now we're back to Guantanamo Bay.
God, imagine Guantanamo Bay for Operation Yew Tree.
Even worse, I heard it as Quintanamo Bay. Where actually the torture is just that you're stuck in a room with Quentin Tarantino as he explains all the minutiae of every single one of his films constantly.
Oh, God. No.
Want to know the original film that he's stolen every single one of his shots from? Because, dear God, you're going to find out.
And then there's the month-long course ominously called Look, It's Not Racist When I Say It, I Grew Up Around Black People.
He's not a good guy, is he, Quentin Tarantino?
For someone whose films I like, I am certainly keen to never meet him.
Oh yeah, that, I'm saying this as a big fan of his films. He is the worst person.
Worse than Scarlett Johansson?
Ooh, that's... I think the problem is they're both on a level where you just can't quantifiably measure it anymore.
Which is weird because Tom Cruise is ridiculously nice, even though he's a Scientologist.
Yes, but also that's because he's completely insane.
Maybe that's the secret.
What?
If you actually lose any vestige of sanity, you're probably, like, quite chilled out.
There's some truth to what you say.
I'm really talking myself out of film career here, aren't I?
Well, if you do, there's always a job in the Maldives.
Yes. To round off,
yep.
A bit of paperback news, specifically paperback news, because at the end of last year, Grady Hendrix released a book in America, I don't think it's available over here yet, called Paperbacks from Hell, a look back at the boom in horror paperbacks of the 1970s and 80s, complete with loads of fabulous lurid cover art for books with titles like Miss Finney Kills Now and Then, Night Shriek, The Succubus, and my first personal favourite, Guyler, with an exclamation mark on the end.
Sorry, what was that called?
Like a Guyler monster.
Oh!
Guyler!
Isn't it pronounced Healer?
As in, maybe.
I think it's pronounced Healer Monster.
Okay.
I'm very interested in this.
Yes. There are some amazingly 1970s topics covered, such as aliens who have an allergy to the band Kiss.
Now that is an amazing idea.
Yes.
Just going to throw this out there, right? There was an anime series called Macross where they fought off aliens with music. And so this just sings to me now. I want this story. I demand this story.
I mean, aliens with an allergy to Kiss would be hard to differentiate from humans living after the 1980s.
I mean, that's the twist, that they're actually just human beings from the far future.
Yes. Are we sure Kiss aren't still alive at that point?
I mean, they're still going. I'm not sure I would say that anyone is happy about that fact, but...
As Gene Simmons has literally just pickled his entire body.
Yes.
Thing is, they're doing mergers with bands from around the world. A couple of years ago, they did one with the making of video for this was just really bizarre. Kiss had a song called Samurai Son, and then there's a band in Japan called Momoira Clover Z. And
yeah.
They're all tiny Japanese women who wear like this weird kind of frilly dresses and the armor and stuff like that. And you've got Gene Simmons and the rest of Kiss in full regalia, and they're giants compared to these tiny little Japanese women. And just seeing the difference in height between the two of them was weird.
I've got to say, a corporate merger with a band from Japan is exactly the sort of thing I expect Kiss to be doing.
Yep.
But yes, so after the success of Paperbacks from Hell, Quirk Books, who published it, actually going to bring out several of the paperbacks covered that are out of print now. They're going to bring them back into print.
I am so buying the aliens.
I want them. I want them all.
Yes.
There is no confirmation of which of the books covered will be back out yet, but it's to be hoped that it's the one that got Grady Hendrix first interested in this area. Apparently he fell down the 70s and 80s horror paperback rabbit hole after buying a book called The Little People about S&M obsessed Nazi dwarves.
What a sentence. I thought Miss Finney kills every now and then was going to be the highlight, but damn.
Great times, eh?
I don't know how to follow that.
Shall we follow it with a book review?
Yes, yes, please.
I don't think anything's going to live up to that, but sure, go for it.
I wish I was reviewing a book about S&M obsessed Nazi dwarves, but alas.
They're my favourite Saturday morning cartoon.
But yes, Titan Books sent us Paul Tremblay's very successful horror novel, The Cabin at the End of the World. It sold very well, and reading it, I can understand why.
Okay.
It's about a 7-year-old called Wen, who was adopted from China by her parents, Eric and Andrew. They're on holiday in New Hampshire, where a very tall, very nervous man called Leonard approaches her while she's out collecting grasshoppers and says that they don't want to hurt anyone, but we need to meet your family as something very grave is happening to the outside world, and the apocalyptic overtones of the title, The Cabin at the End of the World, are absolutely merited. It becomes an apocalyptic story, but an apocalyptic story that takes place in this almost theatrically limited space. It only ventures outside of the titular cabin at the very start and the very end of the book, and context on how badly the outside world is faring as this situation unravels is provided through news broadcasts. So it's a book of limitation. It's a book where the fact that the characters cannot easily get to information about the outside world is part of the tension. Obviously, it's a book about entrapment, a book about the inability to escape. And it's also, I think, about the sort of personal guilt meeting the world on a large scale. Because if every successful horror story is exploiting an anxiety that readers at the time will have, I think Paul Tremblay's novel is about the countless little sins that we commit every day. It's about environmental guilt. It's about sort of guilt in participating into a society that appears to be corrupt and appears to be failing its citizens. It's about all the things you can do which make you think, well, yeah, but what else is there?
Yes, you know, Nazi dwarves, that's what else there is.
It's about guilt at saying the phrase S&M Nazi dwarves so many times.
I'll never feel guilt for that.
I'm not talking about moral guilt. Legally, it is a hate crime. I really enjoyed this, and I think it's strongly characterised. Tremblay opens it up slightly at the start, sort of flashbacks tied to what's happening. For example, when a character is injured, there's a flashback to a football concussion that he saw a long time ago. He's very sparing that. He's very aware that if we use this could dissipate the tension of these characters in a closed environment. I think one thing that is really strong is the characterization of Leonard and his compatriots, who could easily have just been scary fanatics. But from the start, there was something very weird about Leonard. I mean, he is clearly a menacing figure. He's very tall. He's plans are obviously quite sinister even before you know what exactly he's trying to do, and once you do know what he's trying to do, absolutely horrible. But he is weirdly apologetic about it, and there is a fine and strange running gag that as Leonard and his gang terrorize when Eric and Andrew and tie them up and force them to do horrific things, Leonard is always absolutely adamant that there is no kind of homophobic or racist motivation here. You know, it's this weird sort of element of modern manners where they are fanatically convinced that they need to do terrible things to this family in order to avert the apocalypse. But it's not like a bigoted thing. It's not personal like that.
I don't really like that.
Yeah, there is this undercurrent. It never becomes overt, but there is an undercurrent of black comedy in it, and there is one particularly telling moment where a large slick of blood is mopped up with Wen's Harry Potter tea towel, which it feels like a statement of some description. I'll give it that. I think Tremblay has a really memorable turn of phrase. I like that there's a lovely moment where Wen says she's happy to be called sneaky, because people who are fast are just fast, but people who are sneaky are fast and clever.
I like that.
It's a very good observation, isn't it? And it's full of these little human details that keep what could have been a very schematic plot into the realm of something that is happening to people you believe in. And obviously it would be an absolute crime to say how it ends, but I think having set up a dilemma which appears completely unresolvable, Tremblay finds an interesting and suitably not cop-out way to bring the book to a conclusion. So I think it's a really inspired, tense, unique horror novel that does a lot with expanding on a very small, simple and strong idea. I really liked this a lot. It's The Cabin at the End of the World by Paul Tremblay, and it's out now in Titan Books.
Awesome.
That does sound very good.
That does sound very, very good. So, yeah, on that note, that's us done for today. You can catch all of our shows and every other show on the Geek Show Podcast Network on our website, geekshow.co.uk. That's it from us. We will see you next time on Literary Loitering. Until then, I have been Rob. And nobody else?
I was waiting for Andrew, so we don't do the thing that we always do.
I was waiting for Graham so that we don't do the thing we always do.
But you just did the... I've been Graham.
And I've been Andrew.
Yeah, I was going to say, you just literally did the thing you always do, only in reverse. We'll see you all later.
Thanks for listening.